Then I had somebody sent in a couple of questions here, which I'll reply to. So somebody's asking, can you explain a bit more about the power of the virtuous object? Because last time I talked about the story about the old man who wanted to become enlightened, and Shariputra couldn't see that he had enough merit to do that, but the Buddha, whose clairvoyant powers were greater, was able to see that in a previous life, the continuity of this old man had been born as a fly that landed on a piece of cow dung that floated around a stupa, and by having this kind of contact with a holy object, that, you know, that positive imprint was put on the mind. Okay, so this person is who asked the question here is saying, well, it kind of sounds like it's all inherently existent, you know, because that fly certainly didn't have a positive motivation to create any good karma. And we're usually told, you know, that the kind of karma we create principally depends upon our motivation. Well, the fly didn't have a good motivation, so what's the story with him creating some virtue by, you know, floating around a stupa on a piece of cow dung? That sounds like, you know, stupas have inherently existent powers to create merit. Okay, well, no, they don't have inherently existent powers. They have dependently existent powers. Okay, now, here's how I personally understand this thing, okay, about like the power of the holy object, and in this case, just by that fly seeing the stupa, how it affected the fly's mind. Okay, if you think about, you know, because they've done scientific studies, that if you're watching a movie and for a split second, so that even you aren't conscious of having seen it, if they flash across the screen, you know, drink Pepsi or something, then you aren't conscious that you've seen that, but you know, pretty soon you'll get up and go out and buy some Pepsi. Okay? So, yeah. So I kind of understand this thing about the power of the holy objects in a similar way. You know, because here's something that we didn't even consciously realize, but, you know, it said drink Pepsi, and it had an effect on our mind. Even though we had no motivation to understand it, we didn't even know that we had perceived it, but just by the force of that appearing to our mind, it influenced us in a certain way. So in the same way, the way my thinking says, you know, if you see a statue of the Buddha, if you see a stupa, you know, if you see something like that, it affects your mind in a certain way, you know. And I mean, we can tell that from our own experience. And for example, you know, if you have an altar in your house, and you know, there's the Buddha sitting, and he's so peaceful and tranquil, and you walk past your altar, and your mind is like going a gazillion miles an hour, and you're going, I have to do this, and I have to do that, and I'm late for this, and I'm late for that. And then you look at your altar, and there's the Buddha, and he's sitting there so quietly. Just that form of the statue does something to your mind, doesn't it? You kind of go, oh, wait a minute. I should, you know, I want to try and be like that. I don't need to be crazy like I am right now. Okay? So just, you know, that object appearing to your mind, that statue of the Buddha, you know, it influences the mind in a certain way and reminds you of a certain thing. Okay? So it's in this way that I think, you know, when we have some contact with a holy object, you know, because of the form, the structure of the object or the energy, you know, from how people have related to that object, then, you know, that affects our mind. I mean, you see people who don't have any spiritual belief at all, and they'll go to Bodh Gaya, India, you know, where the enlightenment stupa is, where the Buddha attained full enlightenment. And these are people who aren't Buddhists, who have no faith at all, but they go there. And they walk around and they come out and they're going, whoa, you know, there was something special going on there. And so, you know, these things affect our mind. I mean, if you watch a violent movie on television, doesn't that affect your mind? Yeah? It does. If you watch a violent movie right before you go to sleep, yeah, what are you going to dream about? Even if it's not right before you go to sleep, if you're watching violent movies, you know, it affects what you dream about, it affects what you think about, because those images are appearing to the mind, and our mind is, you know, is not very strong and doesn't know how to interpret them, and so they just bring out our violent qualities. Yeah, I think it's so amazing in our society how, you know, we have to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars to do scientific investigation to see that if playing violent videos affects teenagers' minds and makes them violent. I mean, duh! You know, you need to spend thousands of dollars to find out that this is harmful for teenagers' minds, and not only teenagers, but adults' minds. You know, because you see that, it affects your mind. If you see a stupa, if you see a picture of the Buddha, if you see a picture of His Holiness Dalai Lama, it affects your mind in a totally different way. You know? So you could see that, you know, there's some power to the holy objects in this way. Okay, so that's how I understand these kinds of things. Then the second question this person asked is, can you explain how we receive blessings and in what way the mind opens or becomes able to receive teachings from the Buddha? Well, I can't give you, you know, a step-by-step analytical report of how we receive blessings, okay? But how does our mind become open to receiving teachings? You know, this all has to do with the whole issue of purification and creation of positive potential. And I remember when I was a beginning Buddhist, I kept on saying, how do you know you've purified? What does it mean to purify? What's all this positive potential bit? And how do you know that you've accumulated it? And, you know, I would ask people, and I couldn't kind of get real clear explanations, and people would just say, well, you know, do the practice and you'll kind of figure it out. And they were actually right. And so, for example, how do I know that there was some kind of purification or accumulation of positive potential or some kind of blessing? Well, just an instance from my own life. When I did the 3-month Vajrasattva retreat, okay, so, you know, 3 months, you're sitting there doing Vajrasattva visualization and mantra. Actually, I spent most of the 3 months reliving my life, and once in a while I got distracted and thought about Vajrasattva. But, you know, it was mostly just kind of rehashing my whole life and figuring out what I've been doing. And I kept on saying, how is this purifying? What's purification? What's good karma? And then I went back, I had been studying at Copan then, and I went back to Copan for the course, the autumn course, right after finishing the Vajrasattva retreat. And I was listening to teachings again, and I was going, oh my goodness, this sounds completely different. You know, I thought, you know, what Laman Rinpoche were teaching was like something I had never heard before. Actually, the topics were the same topics. But I heard them in a totally different way. Why did I hear them in a totally different way? Because there had been some purification and some collection of positive potential. You know? And you know how it is. I mean, those of you who've been around for a while, you'll hear a teaching one time, and then you'll go back and hear that teaching taught some other time, maybe a few years later, and it sounds like, wow, it's so much more profound this time. Yeah. Actually, the words may be just the same, but the way in which we're understanding things has been different. And so I think some of this purification happens because of our faith and confidence in the Buddha. And this doesn't mean blind faith. It means, you know, faith or confidence that comes from having studied the teachings and thought about them. You know, some of it happens by kind of relaxing the intellectual mind from time to time and working with the symbols that we use in purification practice, yeah, which are very, very effective. You know, you meditate on light coming from the Buddha purifying your negative karma, and, you know, that kind of meditation and symbolic imagery really helps you to let go of a lot of stuff. And so as the more we let go of old stuff, then the more receptive we are to the teachings, the better we understand the teachings. And receiving a blessing, actually blessing, the Tibetan word, if you translate it, it means transforming into magnificence. Okay, so it means the mind being transformed. It's not, you know, something that you get from the Buddha, just by the Buddha, like bonking us on the head with, you know, a vase full of holy water, or, you know, a magic wand or something. But receiving a blessing has to do with the knowledge and the power of somebody else's spiritual realizations, and the receptivity in our own mind that we've created through practicing and, you know, through hearing, contemplating and practicing the teachings. Okay, and so through that whole dependent arising, then, you know, sometimes we get some strong experience and we understand something in a way that we hadn't understood it previously. Okay, so our hour is up. Okay, so meditate on these various powers of the Buddha, thinking about them. Yeah, if you have a discussion, if you know you're listening to the teachings with the group and you're having a discussion afterwards, then just kind of, you know, discuss how these powers and how you know, how it could be that somebody attains them, and talk about the advantage of these an enlightened being having these kind of powers, and how that could make a Buddha a reliable guide for us to develop trust in and take refuge in. Okay, so you can use this description to talk about how the Buddha is a reliable object of refuge. Okay, so let's dedicate now.